Chapter 26. 7 days in June. The Liddy Awards were, in a word, extra. It was the black book world's big chance to celebrate itself. And since people born of the African diaspora tended to turn celebrating themselves into an art form, the festivities were lavish. Also, it was open to the public for the first time and being streamed live on BET.com. The sponsors included Target, Ciroc, Essence, Nike, and Carol's daughter. An exciting professional moment, to be sure, but Eva was adrift in a sea of conflicting feelings. Every feeling, it seemed. After writing and sobbing, and writing and sobbing for hours, she was more than a bit delirious. Dizzy from pain, loopy from meds, fiercely proud of what she'd written. Desperate for waffles, itchy from Spanx, and then, of course, there was her heart. Eva was heartsick. She'd written through it because she was a fucking pro, but the helpless, searing ache in her heart was too big. Ignoring it was useless. She refused to let it take over. Because even bigger than her sadness was her determination. She was at the Liddies, not just as a nominated author, but as a woman on a mission. With every word she'd written, her purpose had become clearer than ever. Eva Mercy was focused on the future, her next step, and no one, not Shane, not even herself, was going to rattle her. This new Eva, the free Eva, was tired of being rattled by life. How long had she lived being too terrified to show her real self? There was power in showing the messiness of her life and what it took to hold it together. This week had liberated her, and whether she liked it or not, Shane had a lot to do with it. She felt free with him. God damn him, she thought to herself, squeezing her eyes shut, wishing she could banish his ridiculously lovely face from her brain. This isn't about him. It's about me. Occupying all the space I need to, standing tall in exactly who the hell I am. A damned good mom, and writer with a terrible disability who overcomes it every day, and whose best work is ahead of her, and whose ass is perched for the gods in her dress. Eva was wearing a vintage Alexander McQueen number she'd borrowed from Cece. The long-sleeved, sharp-shouldered leather mini-dress was a badass goth purple. Very Rihanna, circa Disturbia, said Cece. And because she truly was committed to being her authentic self, she wore it with platinum door-knocker earrings and Stan Smith sneakers. The outfit was symbolic. Gia's signature color was purple. Sebastian's fangs were platinum. And tonight, she was saying goodbye to them both. But for now, she was sitting at a round table in the dazzling ballroom of Cipriani Wall Street. The space was already dramatic, with its grand cathedral-like interior and mile-high ceilings. And tonight, it was all gussied up in Harlem Renaissance drag. The 40 author tables were decked out with sumptuous silver and black linens and Jazz Age-inspired centerpieces. Massive crystal champagne glasses overflowing with chunky strings of pearls. Lights were low, and a spotlight shone Black Literary Excellence Awards 2019 on the dance floor. The all-female R&B band was clad in flapper gowns. The look slightly clashed with its upscale black barbecue set list, which included up-tempo hits by Frankie Beverly and Maze, Mary J. Blige, Tina Marie, Kool & the Gang, and several artists produced by Teddy Riley. In the middle of it all was a small stage with an Art Deco podium. It was like a Gatsby-themed wedding, but with awards and no cake. At the moment, Eva was applauding the weepy woman who'd just won Best Historical Fiction. Through grateful tears, she thanked her energy healer and LeVar Burton's Reading Rainbow. And then the MC, OG actress and Blackish star Jennifer Lewis, who had titled her recent memoir The Mother of Black Hollywood, announced that the ceremony was taking a short break so everyone could eat. Resplendent in a belted teal caftan and matching turban, Jennifer looked like a wildly chic fortune teller. As waiters served an already congealed chicken paillard dinner, the band played a strikingly faithful cover of Gin and Juice, and the tipsiest folks hit the dance floor, including Belinda, who was celebrating her best poetry collection win. In the far back of the room, the people in the standing room section, mostly fans, readers, and bookfluencer bloggers, were getting autographs and frantically updating their social media accounts, while most of the nominees, besieged by nerves, stayed in their seats and picked at their chicken. The tables were assigned by award category, and each had its own distinct vibe. The authors at the best chick lit table were glam, on the smoky eyes and sequins level of Bravo reality stars on a reunion episode. The best biography table boasted scholarly 50-something women with Kamala Harris hair and adoring second husbands. Each of the six HBCU alums at the best political current affairs book table sat there with weaponized Twitter fingers flying over their iPhones, smelling faintly of beard oil and weed. Meanwhile, the podcast bros from Best Sports Book were hotly debating the NBA draft to impress their one female co-nominee, a bored, pretty WNBA star-turned-writer who could have dunked on every last one of them. Eva's table was the best erotic romance nominees, an unlikely-looking bunch. Far from sex-crazed floozies, erotica writers were mostly mild-mannered moms wearing their church function finest. Eva had known her competition for ages. Ebony Brannigan, thug passion. Bonnie St. James, so dark her desire. Georgia Hinton, lust and found. And Tika Carter, the sinful CEO part 7, sluttily yours. Every year they were nominated together. And every year, Grand Dame Bonnie St. James won for her series about a raging nymphomaniac working as a female spy in World War II Paris. Bonnie would probably win again, and this certainly made the evening relatively stress-free for Eva's group. While the rest of the ballroom was alight with nerves and halfway to wasted, the civilized erotica writers talked shop. All except Eva. She was half listening to the gals, half keeping an eye on the door across the ballroom. Shane wasn't here. Surely he wouldn't dare come. What would she do if he did? It doesn't matter, she thought, force-feeding herself rice pilaf. Ebony, how do you type with those acrylics? Asked Georgia.
The click-clack sound is so satisfying, she wiggled her fingers. ASMR. Tika, what have you been up to?
I just started leading a collaborative e-course on romance writing.
Wow, said Eva, who didn't know what a collaborative e-course was.
My latest workshop was about incorporating condoms in sex scenes, said Tika in her faux lofty voice.
She was from Gadsden, Alabama, but spoke like she starred in The Crown.
It's our responsibility to promote safe sex.
Oh, please, scoffed Georgia.
As Zane, the queen of erotic fiction, once said, if a reader chooses not to protect themselves because my protagonist robbed her sister's baby daddy during a conjugal visit, then her problems are bigger than condoms.
Tika cocked a brow.
Zane said that?
Well, I'm paraphrasing, huffed Georgia, and then she changed the subject. Eva, what have you been up to, ma'am?
Me? Lost in thought.
Eva was not prepared to jump into this conversation.
Nothing.
Just listening to murder podcasts, mostly. Tika gestured at her with her fork.
Aren't we due for book 15?
Oh, she said with a faraway smile. You know I'm superstitious. I never talk about what I'm working on.
Always so mysterious, Eva, Tika said with a smirk, sipping Prosecco.
Very mysterious, agreed Ebony.
We heard who you're dating. When, what time, and upon what hour did this happen?
Leave that child alone, said Bonnie, finally speaking up. She was a no-nonsense 60-something woman who, no matter what she was doing, always looked like she'd rather be binge-watching 227.
This isn't a high school cafeteria.
Isn't it, though? Thought Eva, who saw a flurry of texts come from Cece, who was seated across the ballroom. Earlier in the evening, Eva had told her about Shane's brunch no-show and was now regretting it.
Today, 9:23 p.m. Queen Cece. Darling, are you hanging in? Today, 9:25 p.m. Queen Cece. Heard from him yet? Today, 9:29 p.m. Queen Cece. If he doesn't show up, I'll kill him. No, I'll let you kill him first. Today, 9:33 p.m. Queen Cece. Eva, you might want to check your FB fan group. I take full responsibility. I'm already drafting a letter to the catering agency, but I think one of the waiters at my party was spying on you and Shane, the redhead. How was I to know she was a cursed Stan? She looked so sophisticated. Eva couldn't deal with Cece's texts right now, and she definitely didn't want to check her fan group. Her category was next. She just wanted to get through this with her head held high and then go home. Lamely, she tried to join the conversation but couldn't find an opening in Georgia's rapid-fire shop talk. She always spoke in romance writer jargon, which was maddening. And in my new novel, I can't decide if I should give my female lead a HEA or HFN. Happily ever after, or happily for now.
Is her man worthy of a happy ending? Asked Ebony.
Hard to say. He's somewhere between an alpha male and an alpha hole. I love writing alpha holes, sighed Tika. Who doesn't enjoy a sexy jerk? Sexy jerks are overrated, muttered Eva.
Your vampire Sebastian's an alpha hole, and he's fabulous, enthused Ebony.
Is he? Countered Eva. Every time he sleeps with Gia, he wakes up on the opposite side of the earth from her. He knows it'll happen because of their curse, but he does it anyway. That's not sexy, she said with a pointed hair toss. That's pathological. Gia's just as much to blame, Georgia pointed out. She's not quite a TSTL heroine, too stupid to live. But almost, no offense. None taken. Gia's definitely TSTL, agreed Eva, her eye sockets starting to thump. Not now, she thought to herself. I can't deal with an episode right now. Just let me get through this night. She's a witch with magic powers, Eva continued, fishing for a gummy in her purse. But in every book, she uses them to fight her way back to a depressed vampire, or to hex the vampire hunters stalking her man. Never once did she consider saving herself, figuring out how to break the curse, or at least putting a love spell on some regular dude who she could have a functional relationship with. But then it'd be over, said Tika. Eva smiled weakly, knives stabbing into her temples. It would be, wouldn't it? She barely got out the words before she broke out in a cold sweat. Between the loud dinner chat, the uproarious laughter from the dance floor, the booming bass from the band, now tearing it up to Where My Girl's At by 702, and this conversation, the low-grade migraine she'd woken up with had surged to possibly vomitous. She needed a painkiller injection. Quickly. You okay, honey? Whispered Grand Dame Bonnie, seated right next to her. The rest of the table had returned to their alpha hole convo. Nodding, Eva swallowed the gummy whole and fanned herself with the menu. She was on fire. I know what to do. Bonnie rolled up the sleeves of her Chico's blazer and grabbed Eva's wrists. Without warning, she held them against her ice-cold Sprite glass. Eva yelped at the shock. But then, in mere seconds, she started to cool down. Her rapid-fire heartbeat even settled a bit. Menopause trick, Bonnie said with a wink. Ever efficient. Listen, whatever's the matter, you'll overcome it. We're made of guts and gumption, honey. Guts and gumption. Great title for your next book, Eva managed a shaky, grateful smile. She scooted her chair back, saying, Excuse me, just need to call my doc. And then she stopped herself. This was her go-to pain emergency excuse when she needed an injection. She was sick of relying on it. So instead, she did something she'd never done before. You know what? I'm not stepping away to call Audrey. Eva threw her shoulders back. The truth is, I have an invisible disability.
A what?
Asked Ebony. A disability. My head is fucking exploding, and it's so bad that, Ebony, your nose is melting into your face, and I'm concerned that I might vomit on my borrowed Alexander McQueen. The edges of my vision are starting to fray and curl like paper on fire. Can you imagine? When I was little, I thought it happened to everyone. I described it to my second-grade teacher once, and she thought my mom was giving me LSD. Wouldn't have been a reach, actually. Bonnie grabbed her clutch. My word, honey, do you want an aspirin? Eva outright giggled. Thank you, Bonnie, but no. If aspirin worked, I'd be a totally different person. I'd be breezing through life like Chrissy Teigen. I'd be married to a pleasant pop star and hosting game shows. I, too, would be the funniest person on Twitter. I'd out Teigen Teigen. Eva was on such a roll, she didn't even notice that the women were looking at her like she was losing it. Actually, I just took an edible, and now I'm going to find a ladies' room and shoot myself with a Toradol injection. She made a stabbing motion at her thigh. No, it's fine. I do it all the time. Feel free to eat my chicken paillard. No reason to let free protein go to waste. See y'all in 10. Eva's words were slurring. Her vision was blurring, but my God, was she exhilarated. Just by that one small, huge admission, she felt unburdened, unshackled. With a triumphant grin, she confidently strode from the table and across the dance floor. Holding a temple, she pinballed through the maze of people until she was sideswiped by Khalil. He grabbed her by the waist and dipped her dramatically. Without hesitation, she elbowed him in the ribs, and ignoring his wail, "Senseless violence, sis," she headed toward the back of the room. The only thing standing between her and the exit doors to the lobby was the standing room only crowd of fans, book club members, and Goodreads contest winners, just there to support their favorite authors. They were a lively bunch, rocking tees and totes, repping their favorite books. One woman was dressed up like the cover of Tiffany Haddish's The Last Black Unicorn. Another was convincing Tayari Jones to sign her iPhone case. Scanning the crowd for an opening, Eva lasered in on a group in the back. Wow, they were especially loud and loudly dressed. And familiar. They were... Wait. Barely 5'3" in her sneakers, she rose to her tippy toes and saw the witch hats, the brooms, the platinum S-rings. One woman held a sign with the pic of Eva and Shane eating ice cream. In Sharpie, she'd written, "Best of luck to Eva and her real-life Sebastian tonight." A dude had silkscreened Shane's photo on his tee, accompanied with a quote from Cursed, Book 1. His eyes were a curious bronze, like a tumbler of brandy illuminated by the sun. Another woman, with a very familiar-looking coppery bob, brandished a poster reading, "High School Sweethearts, Best-Selling Bays, Hashtag Sebastian and Gia Are Real." High School Sweethearts? But no one knew. Eva squinted at the woman, the red bob. She slapped her palm over her mouth. It was the hovering waitress from Cece's party. Quickly, she checked the latest post on her Facebook fan group. The Cursed Crew Group. Major fandom news. I spotted Eva and Shane Hall at a Brooklyn party, very together, and I overheard that they dated in high school, and I overheard that Sebastian is based on him. We've found our Sebastian, kids. Hashtag stay cursed. Eva's migraine was face-meltingly, unreasonably awful. And now she was being hit with the fact that her best friend would accidentally hire a cursed fan to pass out shrimp. Eva was horrified. She wanted to clean it up, to march up to that spying waitress and demand that she stop spreading lies. But they weren't lies. Shane was Sebastian, and they were high school sweethearts. Every author got inspiration from somewhere, and her muse just happened to be a real person. It was the truth, and it was hers, and she had nothing to hide. A week ago, being exposed in this way would have killed her. But tonight, Eva accepted it. She'd done this. She'd whipped her fans into this frenzy over the years. She could finally see that their devotion was a testament to her work. To her, Sebastian and Gia were a burden. But to her readers, they were live or die love. something to root for. And then, despite her pounding head and rising nausea, clarity hit her. This was exactly what she didn't want. She wanted steady love, a love that was too ordinary to inspire fiction, a collection of sacred, small, everyday moments, not high-stakes drama. She wanted a relationship that was a choice every minute of every day. Fighting back tears, she wove her way to the group. Before anyone could react to her presence, Eva abruptly and enthusiastically embraced a fan wearing platinum fangs. The group gasped.
"Eva Mercy, as I live and breathe," exclaimed the fanged fan. "What's that for?"
"For staying with me all these years. In a ballroom of great writers, you picked me. Thank you." With that, she made her way to the exit, unburdened, unshackled. Shane was pacing in the lobby, the muted sounds of music and applause floating through the doors. He'd been pacing for so long, he was beginning to worry that he'd never have the nerve to enter the ballroom. The lobby was empty, except for a few photographers and junior publicists hanging around the step and repeat. Every so often, the doors would open and people would rush through to the lounges. But no one bothered him, which was no accident. His expression strongly discouraged people from wanting to chat. Shane had left the airport bathroom so quickly he hadn't gotten a chance to check his appearance. He was a bleary-eyed, unshaven wreck in the cobalt-blue Tom Ford suit he didn't remember buying or packing. Sore from head to toe, he'd been clenching every muscle in his body all day. He hadn't eaten. He was still reeling. He'd lost Ty. By the time Shane had gotten to the hospital, Ty was on a ventilator and unresponsive. Shane held his large, soft hand, willing him to wake up. He bargained with him, promising Ty that he'd do everything to keep him safe, that he'd visit Providence once a month, no, twice a month. He'd buy an apartment in town where Ty could stay. Shane told him that he'd never have to do anything dangerous for money again, that he'd give Ty whatever he needed. Finally, he recited the planets over and over until his voice cracked and the futility of it made continuing too painful. It was no use. Ty was gone. So Shane said goodbye. His loss felt too great, too raw to process. But despite how hollowed out he felt, he willed himself forward. He could think of only one thing now, what he was going to say to Eva. This time, he would be prepared. It wouldn't be like when he showed up a week ago winging it. She deserved more than that. He wrote an entire speech on the plane. He practiced in the rental car he drove to the Liddies. And now he was rehearsing as he was pacing. Shane was ready. Until Eva burst through the doors of the lobby, shocking the hell out of him. She breathed in a dramatic gasp and then cringed, pressing a knuckle into her temple. He saw a flurry of emotions mar her expression, and then nothing. An ice-cold, terrifying calm settled over her face. Shane forgot everything he'd planned to say. "Hello," she said.
"Hey,"
he rasped, and didn't recognize his voice. He hadn't spoken in hours. Clearing his throat, he walked in her direction. She crossed her arms over her chest, and message received. He stopped in his tracks just a few feet away from her. God, Eva was breathtaking, even in her remoteness. Shane's chest clenched. "I'm sorry," he managed.
"Don't apologize."
"I can explain."
"So can I," she said crisply, and closed the space between them so they were a few feet apart. "I'm sure you have a good reason for standing us up. Maybe you forgot. Maybe it was too much, too fast. And fair enough. But you didn't just stand me up, you stood up my daughter. You don't promise things to kids and then disappear."
For reasons Eva couldn't know, this seemed to hit him like a punch to the jaw.
"Believe me," said Shane. "I know. It was just a silly brunch, but I thought..."
Eva stopped, swallowed, and started over.
I know it's only been a week, but it felt bigger, he said, his voice breaking on the word. Just then, a group of women swept through the doors on their way to the ladies' lounge, and the ballroom noise roared into the lobby. The women rushed by, ignoring them. I'm sorry for letting you two down. Audrey, she's incredible. You're both more than I thought I'd ever get, and I've never been held accountable to anyone before. This is new. I don't know how to do it yet. Eva moved closer to him, searching his face. He couldn't meet her eyes, but he imagined what she must be seeing. His eyes rimmed dark, his two-day stubble, his features etched in grief. Look at me, she said. When Shane's eyes met Eva's, his heart flared and burst, flickering out like a spent light bulb, and he wondered why the sweetest things in his life had to be poisoned with tragedy. What happened to you? Scratching the side of his jaw, he thrust his hands into his pockets. The women passed back through the doors to the ballroom. Eva and Shane heard Jennifer Lewis order everyone to their seats to get ready for the next category. They didn't move. Tell me what happened, she whispered. One of my students was shot. Say his name. Ty. And he didn't have anyone. He was all alone in a hospital, and he was hurt with no parents who cared. Just like us. Remember? Eyes widening, Eva nodded. He'd been trying to call me, but I was too busy. I was happy, so I ignored him. I was so fucking happy. Shane shook his head. He died today. He's gone. 13 years old. 13. I promised him I'd be there, and I wasn't. Shane. I guess that's what I do to people. I don't deserve a family. I can't. His words were cut off, because Eva gathered him into her arms, and her grip was so tight, she almost knocked the wind out of him. Stop. You deserve a family. It wasn't your fault. Shane was almost too numb to react, but then, after a few moments, he slid his arms around her waist, pulling her flesh against him. And finally, his muscles released. He slumped against her, face nestled in the crook of her neck, giving in to the grief. It wasn't your fault, she repeated, pressing her lips against his temple. Shane nodded, but it felt like nonsense. Just the words people have to say when someone's hurting. He squeezed her tighter anyway, grasping the leather of her dress in his fists. At some point, from inside the ballroom, they heard Jennifer Lewis's muffled voice announce Eva's category.
Back to your seats, culleds. Time for the Best Erotic Romance Award. Where are my sex writers at? Child, good thing I don't write what goes on in my dirty ass mind. Y'all be filing for unemployment. I see you, Bonnie. You know I'm dirtier than you.
That's you, Shane said.
I know.
Neither moved, still holding on to each other. From far away, they heard Jennifer's booming voice over the mic, ordering the Liddy president to hand her the envelope. She began reading off the nominees. It's not your fault, Eva repeated, louder this time. Shane wondered if perhaps she was right. Maybe it was true and none of this was his fault. And maybe there were people out there who could really let themselves off the hook. Maybe he could have been that person if he hadn't caused his foster mom's death, or disappeared on Eva, or if he'd been there for Ty when he needed him. Until he learned how to absolve himself, forgive himself, he had no business escaping into a relationship with Eva. He'd just bring those demons with him. And then, for the first time ever, Shane ignored what he desperately wanted and made his first truly responsible decision. I can't do this, he said. Us. Eva let out a tiny sigh and pulled out of the hug. Palming his cheeks, she rested his forehead against hers. No, you can't. And Louisiana? I'm going without you, she said definitively. It's fine. I don't want to hurt you or Audrey, he said, his voice tinged with resigned sadness. I'm not good enough for you yet, but I want to be, and I'll work on it. I promise. Shane couldn't believe it was over, that they were dissipating like wispy plumes of smoke. It was impossible to tell what Eva was thinking. She seemed sturdy with resolve. Don't make promises, she whispered. Our promises don't stick. Eva, just be kind to yourself. I'll try. Are you going to drink? No. Are you going to hurt yourself? His eyes flashed with such pain that Eva dropped her hands from his face. Shane, nothing hurts worse than this. Eva's breathing went choppy, and she shut her eyes, wanting to unsee the crushing vulnerability in his face. She'd never imagined that losing Shane a second time would tear at her like this, in new, adult places. It was unbearable. So then, almost imperceptibly, she slid on a tough veneer, an old affectation that was pure Genevieve. Crossing her arms in front of her, she tilted up her chin with faux bravery. Here's a thought. Maybe we work better as a flashback, she shrugged broadly. You know, meet once every 15 years, for 7 days in June, make some memories, move on. Maybe, he looked at her. From the ballroom, Jennifer Lewis's voice boomed, and the winner is... Eva and Shane stood there unmoving. Eva Mercy for Cursed, Book 14. Shane immediately swept her into an embrace, his face aglow, and helplessly, she let go of the old armor and allowed herself to luxuriate in his arms, to breathe him in one last time. You won, he whispered. You won. She turned her face up to his, and because he couldn't imagine not doing it, he kissed her. A soft, bittersweet, lingering kiss that radiated through her everywhere. In a voice so low that Shane may have imagined it, Eva whispered, and the lost. At the podium, Eva gripped the cool, heavy glass award in her palms. The lights were too blinding, driving daggers into her temples, so she couldn't make out faces in the crowd, which was good. Lord knows she hadn't prepared anything. Thank you. Really, just thank you. You can't imagine what this award means to me. I grew up with these characters. They're in my DNA. And I'm so proud that my readers love them as much as I did, which is why it hurts me to tell them this. There isn't going to be a book 15. A guy brandishing a witch's broom at the back of the room let out a piercing shriek. I'm so sorry, sir, she swallowed. For half my life, I've hidden behind these characters. I've hidden in general. I've spent so much time being scared of digging too deep into who I really am, for fear of what I might find, what ghosts I might confront, secrets I might uncover. Better to bury it all. I thought I couldn't be a successful person if I had demons. But what fully realized person doesn't? No one expects men to be flaw-free. Women are expected to absorb traumas both subtle and loud and move on, shoulder the weight of the world. But when the world fucks with us, the worst thing we can do is bury it. Embracing it makes us strong enough to fuck the world right back. So instead of writing about Gia, a witch who uses her powers to fight for a man, I'm fighting for myself. I'm not even sure who I am because I've been in hiding for so long. But I do know that I'm Delphine's great-granddaughter, Clotilda's granddaughter, and Lisette's daughter. I come from a long line of weirdos, outsiders, and misfits. I'm a misfit, and my purpose is to give us all a voice. I'm going to write their story, which is mine too. But I'll always appreciate Cursed, and my readers too. I wish I could have tied up the series for you in a bow, but I couldn't. How do you finish a love story that you never wanted to end? She could barely eke out that last sentence. Anyway, she continued, thank you.
for letting me write for you for so long.
An hour later, Shane accepted his Langston Hughes Lifetime Achievement Award. At the podium, he stood in silence for 5 seconds, then 10, 20. His expression was unreadable to everyone. Everyone except Eva. Finally, Shane angled the microphone up and spoke 5 words.
"This is for the misfit."
And with that brief speech, which was tweeted and retweeted so relentlessly that both Cursed and 8 fans began calling themselves hashtag misfit hive, the 2019 Liddies were a wrap.
Epilogue. It was midnight on July 4th in Bellefleur. Genevieve Mercier, long-lost child of the bayou, sat gazing out the window of her Aunt Da's guest bedroom. It was velvety black outside, save for the occasional firecracker illuminating the sky, the prismatic colors reflecting off the lake just beyond the house. The horizon was eternal, endless, complete. All that existed was the swampy lake and a dramatic sky. America was celebrating itself, and Eva was feeling brave. So she picked up her phone. Today, 12:47 a.m., Eva.
Hope this isn't weird. Just checking in to see how you're doing.
Shane.
Oh, hi. I'm good.
Eva.
Great. You are?
Shane. No. I'm sad, but trying not to be. Been trying to stay busy, running 8 miles a day, researching clean eating again. Eva.
Yeah? What are you eating?
Shane. Well, I get choice paralysis at Whole Foods and end up going to the bodega for dinner. Have you tried Entenmann's lemon iced cake? Fucking triumph of unnatural ingredients. I don't know. I guess I'm flailing. I don't really know how to mourn properly.
Eva. No one does. But maybe grief counseling could help?
Shane. Maybe. But enough about me. Tell me about Bellefleur. Everything.
Eva. It's heaven.
Hot, humid,
haunted heaven. It's such a vivid place. It's like people settled here 3 centuries ago and no one left.
Everyone's related. The supermarket checkout lady asked me who my people was, and when I told her I was a Mercier, she listed like 9 ways we were cousins.
I feel like I'm home on this bayou full of short people who inherited generations of farms and fields and stories and terror and rage and brilliance and resilience and gumbo and culture. And everyone looks like me.
Shane, everyone looks like you? The fucking promised land.
Eva, smiley face.
Shane, Eva, it sounds revelatory. Can we talk? I just want to hear your voice.
Eva, I can't talk to you yet.
Shane,
okay, I understand.
Reading your words was almost as good.
2 days later. Shane collapsed on the grass in the middle of Washington Square Park after running his usual 8 miles around Lower Manhattan. He was bathed in sweat, sticky and pissed off. Running was supposed to make him feel good, and it did while it was happening, but after, when his heart was thundering, his chest was burning, and his darkest, most buried thoughts were suddenly excavated, crystal clear and loud, there was only one thing he wanted to do. And he couldn't. Shane couldn't risk hurting her, so he had to find a way to fix himself by himself. He wanted to talk to her. That was where Shane was, flat on his back a mere 6 feet from a fleet of meditating Hare Krishnas, when he got a text from her. A voice note. Just her voice.
Shane?
Hi.
I said I couldn't talk to you yet, and I can't.
I'm not ready to hear your voice, but I know you're in pain, so it might help you to hear mine. I'm just gonna talk, okay?
Where do I start?
So I'm staying with my Aunt Da. She found me on Facebook's Belle Fleur Creoles page after I posted that I was looking for a room to rent. Da is short for Ida. Two syllables takes too long down here. Also, she's not really my aunt. She's my grandma's second husband's niece, but no one keeps score. You'd love her, cause... Eyes shut, grinning. Shane folded his hands on his chest and drifted. Later that day. Today, 3:23 p.m. Shane. What you doing? Eva. Cowering in a corner. Shane. Why? You okay? What's wrong? Eva. I'm in mortal terror. Aunt Da's house is so charming, but it's been in her family since the 1880s. It's old, with water bugs, and there's a huge one on my bed. Shane. Huge like what? Eva. Like Chris Christie, okay? Like Uncle Phil. Huge. Shane. LOL. You're in the South, right? Lean into it. Lure him into a mason jar, deposit him under the shade of a mighty magnolia tree. Pour him a mint julep and skedaddle. Eva. I saw Aunt Da smush one with her thumb, right on her kitchen counter. It crunched like it had bones, Shane, and I crumbled. You know I feel such a kinship with Aunt Da, but when she did that, it hit me like, wow, lady, we're from different worlds. Sorry, gotta go. It's moving. A day later. Today, 2:40 p.m. Shane, did the water bug eat you? Eva, yes. I'm texting from his larynx. What are you doing? Shane, wondering how your head's doing in that humidity. Eva, truthfully, I'm in ferocious pain right now. Still in bed. Shane, fuck. Is there anything I can do to help from here? They got Seamless on the bayou? Eva, too nauseous to eat. You know what'd help? If you told me a story. An original one. Actually, no. I want a poem. Shane, you're V demanding. I'm a terrible poet, but I got you. Hold on. Shane, ellipses. Shane, ellipses. Shane, there once was a girl named Eva. I liked her the moment I seed her. Wish I could have lived in her dimple if only life were that simple. I was a fool to ever leave her. There once was a boy named Shane who'd kill to ease her pain. If only he could change the past. If only this poem didn't suck ass. But Eva has only herself to blame. Eva, this is my favorite poem of all time. Shane, it could have been better, but nothing rhymes with Genevieve. The next day. Mrs. Fabienne Dupree, or Mama Fay, as she was affectionately called, was 101 years old, with a silver braid wound around her head, cheekbones that screamed Shoshone Nation, and no teeth. The whole town knew her because she'd taught math to four generations of Belle Fleur children in the tiny schoolhouse behind St. Francis Church, which happened to be the oldest American church built by black people and the epicenter of Belle Fleur. Mama Fay knew Delphine, Clotilda, Lisette, and everyone else in the Mercier bloodline. So Eva made a call to the farmhouse that Mama Fay's granddaddy had built, where she lived with her widowed niece. After the niece served Eva a light snack, meat pies, pralines, two slices of pecan pie, tea cakes, and sassafras tea, Eva settled in on Mama Fay's rickety whitewashed porch, and Mama Fay, who was laid out on a wicker recliner, began regaling Eva with tales of the past, with dazzling precision. Mama Fay couldn't recall what she ate for breakfast, but she did remember leading the protest against Clotilda's teenage exorcism back in 1939. Yo, grandma be out there working in the hot sun, getting fits and head pains and all matter of vexings. She had a sickness, but it wasn't witchery. Her fool daddy was scared of her,
That's what. His back went bad round fall 39, and he reasoned Chloe put roots on him.
Jesus married Joseph.
His back went bad because of fast women and slow horses, not his own daughter. Why women gotta be the cause of evilness in a man? Now, I never got married. No. I ain't one of those funny ladies. I just won't fold myself up tiny so as not to put off no man. Anyway, Chloe grew up and married a man same like her daddy, scared. One spring, they crops turned dry, and the husband and the daddy and the same priest, Father Augustine, sprung a second exorcism on her. She let him, went quiet for months, and then shot that husband in the shed. Let folks tell it, she shot him because he was saying in a spiritual in there, and a holy noise poked a demon in her, which I always took issue with. Won't no evil in your grandma. She couldn't long to vibe for nothing, but she was a good girl, an excellent cook, and an even better shot.
Eva was listening, but was soon lost in her own thoughts. For the first time, she could identify the striking difference between herself and her ancestors, aside from successfully mothering a child. She was the first to almost get love right. Delphine, Clotilda, and Lisette had never been able to depend on their men, because their men had never allowed them to be who they were. They'd crushed their true spirits at every turn. But for Eva, Shane had done the opposite. Mama Faye was fitting to divulge even more details, but that's when Eva's phone rang. Apologizing profusely, Eva hurried down the porch steps and perched on an old tire swing hanging from the thick, gnarled branch of an ancient fig tree.
"Hi, Mommy," said Audrey, her voice clear as a bell and giddy sounding.
"Sweetie, I miss you so much," she said breathlessly. She hadn't talked to Audrey in 3 days.
"I got your package with your cameo ring," she enthused. "I was shocked. You're legit giving it to me?"
"I legit am. I think it's supposed to be yours now."
"Why?"
"Long story. I'll tell you when I see you."
"Okay. Mom, I'm having an emergency."
Audrey's voice dropped to a whisper.
"I'm at the mall with my Dadifornia friends, and we ran into the boy."
"Stop."
"Swear. The four of us got ice cream and talked, and ugh, he's so cute, but I don't know if he likes me back. I don't know how to flirt."
Flirt? Eva wasn't going to survive the next 5 years.
"Well,"
she started calmly, "what have you been doing?"
"For the past hour, ignoring him. I can't even look at him. This is hard. I'd almost rather go back to being friends."
"But isn't that all you are?"
"Oh my God, Mom, you don't understand anything."
"Sweetie, don't raise your voice in public." Eva glanced over at the porch and saw that Mama Faye was asleep, her silver hair going glinty in the brilliant sun.
"How's Mr. Hall, Mommy?"
"I'm sure he's fine, but I want to hear more about the boy." Ignoring this, Audrey said,
"Do you think it's weird that he's going to be teaching at my school? Like, are you guys cool?"
"We're adults, Audrey. It's fine. We're friends."
"Yeah, that's what he said. Oh, when you talk to him, tell him that my stepmom Athena has a dermoid. When the doctors removed the cyst, it had a fingernail in it."
"What the whole hell are you talking about?"
"Just tell him. Love you. Bye."
And that was when it happened. As she tried to get up, Eva's foot tangled in the rope dangling from the tire swing. She tripped and fell, and the ancient branch snapped off the tree, toppling on top of her. Its jagged end landed just a few inches from her jugular. She easily could have died. Of course, Eva had lived through near-death experiences twice before. That time in the house on Wisconsin Avenue. Then again at the hands of a dildo. And now this. Eva believed in signs. She knew something dramatic was coming her way. She just didn't know what. When she finally untangled herself from the swing, brushing dirt off her cutoffs and cursing to herself, she saw that Mama Faye had woken up. The old woman laughed a little, a twinkly, tickled sound.
Mercy, eh, women? Y'all do get yourselves tangled up in it, don't you?
3 days later. Today, 3:14 p.m. Shane, I'm leaving 81 Horatio forever.
Eva, you didn't rent it for the whole summer?
Shane, I didn't think that far. Yeah, so now I gotta find a new place. I'm in Crown Heights right now, about to see an apartment. The fuck's Kennedy Fried Chicken?
Eva, stay at my house.
Shane, absolutely not. That's crossing every line.
Eva,
no, it's not. It's empty for the rest of the summer. You'd be keeping an eye on the place, really. You're doing me a favor. Shane, all caps. This feels weird.
Eva, it shouldn't.
Shane, all caps. You sure? Eva, all caps. Yes, stop yelling.
And what's a dermoid?
Shane, you and Audrey been talking about me, I see. Eva, no, we were talking about her stepmom, Athena, who had a dermoid. Shane, ask Audrey if Athena has pictures. Later that evening. Today, 5:35 p.m. Eva.
Hey, I just arrived in New Orleans. I found the house that my great-grandma Delphine owned, the one who mysteriously left Grandma Chloe at birth and moved to New Orleans to pass as a Votalian. I met the granddaughter of her housemaid for coffee. She said Chloe didn't abandon the baby at all. When Delphine's husband saw that baby Chloe was much browner than he and Delphine, he accused her of cheating in the middle of Mass at St. Francis. Then he ran her out of town. She wasn't cheating, of course. You and I know that black folks come out all different shades and colors. But Delphine never forgave herself for abandoning her baby. Remember I told you she wrote a message in lipstick on her bathroom tiles before drowning herself in the tub? Passant blanc, the term for blacks passing for white. She didn't just write it on the wall, she scrawled it all over her body, apparently. Her white son paid a fortune to the NOLA police to keep the scandal out of the papers and off record, to maintain the lie of his racial purity. Shane, that's chilling. The cruelties of colorism. And imagine what we don't know. What's her side of the story? Eva, it's all pretty intense.
Eva, ellipses. Eva, ellipses. Shane, you okay?
Eva, sometimes I wish you were here, experiencing this with me.
Shane, it's all I think about. The next day. Today, 2:15 p.m. Eva, since I've spent the last 24 hours as a go-between, I've decided to start a thread with all three of us. Talk amongst yourselves.
Audrey, Mr. Hall.
Shane, Miss Mercy Moore. What's good? How's Dadafornia?
Audrey, it's fun. But this year is different. I'm noticing things in a more anthropological way. The differences between people, depending on where they're from. There's a North Cali accent, and people dress differently than Brooklyn kids, like they wear Fila instead of Adidas. You know, the older I get, the more my awareness of what is cool is heightened.
Shane, I like that. There's a difference between being cool and being cool aware.
Audrey, Mr. Hall, you get me. Do you like our place?
Shane, I do. But I miss you guys. It's hard being around your stuff and not getting to chill with you two.
Audrey, are you lonely?
Shane, a little. So your mom doesn't want me to ask you for therapy advice, but Eva, all caps, Shane. Shane, I lost someone I was close to, and it's hard. Therapy doesn't work for me, no offense. Any suggestions?
Audrey,
Mr. Hall, you should really go to therapy. Black men don't go, and it's an epidemic.
The next day. Hi, my name is Shane, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict sometimes. I don't want to be here, but a little girl told me I needed to talk about my problems, and honestly, she's only 12, but she's really fucking astute. So I guess I'm here now, or whatever. Yeah, so thanks for having me. He paused. You're a great-looking crowd.
In unison, the Greenwood Baptist Church chapter of Park Slope Alcoholics Anonymous said,
Hello, Shane.
He writes a lot better than he talks, whispered a bleary-eyed redhead in the back.
The following Monday. The day he'd moved in, Eva had sent Shane 5 huge Dracaena plants from IKEA. For your protection, the note said. Shane had no idea what this meant, but he watered those plants religiously. He even faced them toward the sun to optimize the photosynthesis. But one by one, like clockwork, they died. Shane didn't have the heart to throw them out, though. They were from her. He did notice a funny thing, though. He was surrounded by deceased flora, but he felt better than ever. Very late that night. Eva had written all day, and now her eyes were crossing. She curled up in Aunt Da's guest bed to take a break. She scrolled through her contacts until she reached Shane. After a beat, she called.
Is this you?
Hi, she said softly. I just wanted to hear your voice. I wrote 3 chapters today in Grandma Chloe's house, in my mom's childhood bedroom.
What was it like?
Surreal, she said. I never had one bedroom, you know. There were so many, it's a blur.
She grabbed the pillow under her head and held it to her chest, curling herself around it.
Can I ask you a question?
Depends.
On what?
Nothing, just wanted to say it.
I'm serious, said Eva. Do you think this thing between us will ever wear off? Because I'm starting to feel like it won't. And fighting it seems
pointless.
Then there was silence, and Eva heard rustling on the other end of the line.
The truth? I see you everywhere in your house. Everything smells like you. I hate walking out the door. Just want to stay here, be surrounded by you.
Shane paused for a bit. When he spoke again, his voice was low, slow, like he was delivering a truth he was hesitant to admit.
I've been roaming around forever, and I've never been anywhere I wasn't itching to leave.
When Eva hung up, she stared at the ceiling for what felt like forever. If given another opportunity, could she trust Shane not to leave? 3 days later. 9:10 a.m.
Hi,
said Eva. They spoke first thing in the morning every day now.
What are you doing?
Nothing. Just on my way to coach basketball at the Brownsville YMCA.
Brownsville? Since when do you play basketball?
I don't. I'm trash. But I came to a realization. I need to mentor kids. I was doing it wrong before, getting way too close, trying to save them because I couldn't save my foster family, or you. It was unhealthy. With this, I just shout motivational shit from the sidelines, build some self-esteem, and go home. I mean, your home.
Sounds perfect for you, she said.
Hey, quick question.
Would you come here if I asked?
You asking?
Eva paused. This wasn't healthy. No, they weren't supposed to see each other. Wasn't the whole point of breaking up to focus on themselves? Work through past trauma, separately?
But Eva couldn't ignore the dissenting voice in her head, wondering if maybe there was a chance they'd be stronger together.
Whatever curse had befallen her foremothers, Eva had broken it. She was in love with a man who embraced everything about her. She just didn't know if she had enough faith to accept it.
Well, if you needed me, said Shane, I'd come.
That afternoon, Audrey was at a bonfire on Venice Beach with her summer friends and the boy. So fun, but the bonfire thing made no sense. It was almost 90 degrees. She had on a crop top, high-waisted cutoffs, and flip-flops. It was high summer. Why were they creating more heat? She loved California, but she'd never understand the way the natives thought. Also, she missed her mom. They'd just chatted on the phone, and she'd sounded so serious and distracted, as if she were speaking to Audrey from galaxies away. Audrey knew her mother, so she knew something was wrong. What was missing? And there was only one person who could help. Audrey scrolled through her phone and called the sneakiest person she knew. Later that afternoon. Today, 4:17 p.m. Cece. Can you do me a favor? Shane. No. Cece. I know it's last minute, but I need a panelist for the Peachtree Book Festival in Atlanta. Shane. No. Cece. Please. One of my authors got sick, and I have no one to replace her. The organizers called me specifically and asked for a recommendation. It'd be such a feather in my cap. Shane, but I'm not even an author anymore. I've given it up. I'm a full-time teacher and part-time basketball coach who can't shoot free throws. Also, I'm house-sitting for Eva. Cece, come on. They're paying for everything. It's just a weekend. I won't mention that you owe me your life. That Friday night. Eva was a fan of Atlanta. At least the Atlanta she'd seen. She'd visited only for book conferences and signings, and the trips were quick, so she'd never had any non-touristy, off-the-beaten-path experiences. But it seemed to be a vibrant city with delectable food and fine men who spoke like Andre 3000. Also, it was the city that had produced Cece, so it had to be colorful. When Cece invited her to Ken's top-secret, super-surprise 50th birthday party in their hometown, Eva didn't need convincing, especially since Cece was flying all her guests there. Belle Fleur had become Eva's home away from home, so much so that she'd almost declined the invite in favor of the Cochon de Lait happening the same weekend. It was a Creole tradition, an outdoor feast featuring the roasting of whole pigs, Zydeco dancing, games, and gossip. Apparently, Eva's great-uncle, Tejac, won the pig-roasting contest every year, and this year, the competition was fierce because her seventh cousin, Baby Bubba, who was 83, had been seasoning his pig for 3 whole months. Plus, Eva's fourth cousin, Babette Adele, was manning the craft tables, and she'd been spotted at St. Francis Church's pancake breakfast, feeding maple syrup-dipped bacon to a strapping young foreman who was not her fiancé, and Eva was dying to get the details. Small-town life was delicious, and Eva had immersed herself in it, from the Ruta to the Tuta, as Aunt Da said. She'd discovered her people. There was no denying it. But there was also no denying that there was no cake fair, no cochon de lait, no Friday night dance at Tibet Brothers Meeting House, established 1909, powerful enough to make her forget him. Shane was the memory she couldn't escape, the bridge she'd never burn, the shiver she couldn't shake. Maybe this was just her burden to carry the weight of missing him forever. Because who knew when he'd feel stable enough to be with her in a complete way. The reality was he might never get there. But honestly, did that matter? He might never be fully emotionally stable, and Eva certainly wasn't the picture of glowing mental health herself. Maybe they'd always be disasters. But couldn't they support each other and grow together? No one was perfect. And maybe that was what real adult love was. Being fearless enough to hold each other close no matter how catastrophic the world became. Loving each other with enough ferocity to quell the fears of the past. Just fucking being there. Eva sighed, utterly grateful to be taking this quick weekend trip.
This constant internal debate was exhausting. Hopefully, the change of scenery would clear her mind. It was the first time she'd gotten dressed up since she'd left Brooklyn, and she really went for it. Smoky eyes, loose, side-swept curls, and a long-sleeve black floral mini-dress. Eva showed up at Float Away Cafe, a buzzy Mediterranean restaurant, feeling cute and very proud of herself, because she was 15 minutes early so as not to spoil the surprise. The restaurant was breathtaking. A renovated warehouse, the space was intimate and rustic with low lights, soft, twinkly music, and open windows ushering in the balmy night air. And not a soul was there. Eva knew Belinda couldn't make it because she was on tour, and she wasn't sure who else was invited, but they certainly hadn't arrived yet, because except for the incredible-looking, slightly rockabilly waitstaff, the restaurant was empty. A red-lipsticked hostess tapped her shoulder.
"Ma'am," her accent was honey, "are you Eva Mercy?"
"Yes, I'm here for Cece Sinclair's surprise party."
"Got it," she drawled. "Right this way to the courtyard."
"Thank you," breathed Eva, fluffing her hair and following the woman across the empty restaurant. "Do you know if Cece rented out the whole place for the—" Eva's words dissolved into a gasp. The courtyard was bathed in almost darkness, set up to be a romantic garden-style cafe with the starry sky as a canopy. Clusters of gardenias nestled in painted pots, wafting their heady, sultry fragrance into the night air. The hostess led her to a tiny table, impeccably set with crisp white table linens and charmingly mismatched plates.
"You're a bit early," said the hostess, pulling out Eva's chair. "But the rest of the party's on their way. Our manager just said he heard there was a fender bender on I-85. Everyone's stuck in traffic, I bet. You must have just missed it."
"Oh, makes sense." The hostess nodded and sauntered off. Eva took a sip of water, pulled out her phone. She thought about texting Cece, but figured she'd be caught up in pre-party stress. It was always chaotic, those moments before a surprise. Instead, she indulged in her guilty pleasure. In her weaker moments, she scrolled through her and Shane's texts, reliving their relationship. It comforted her, remembering that it was real. Listless, she plucked a gardenia from the vase on her table, sinking her nose into the velvety petals as she read. It was real. She could almost hear him through the texts, hear his slow, DC-inflected rasp, the way his voice dipped and slowed when it was late. Too late to do anything except sleep. But they couldn't stop learning and relearning everything about each other. God, his voice. "Eva?" Eva whipped around. Shane, standing at the entrance to the courtyard with the hostess, who winked at Eva, smiled and raced back inside. She had to be dreaming. Eva squeezed her eyes shut. When she opened them, he was there in front of her, looking like breezy, sexy perfection in a short-sleeve chambray button-down and black jeans. Before her brain could order her mouth to speak, he grabbed her by her shoulders, pulling her to her feet and into his strong arms.
"Shane,"
she gasped, crushing the gardenia in her hand.
"What? Why are you?"
"Cece didn't tell me you were going to be here."
"Of course I'm here. It's Ken's birthday. How could she invite you and not tell me?"
"Ken's birthday? I'm here for the Peachtree Book Festival."
"I've never heard of a Peachtree Book Festival."
"Me either. But what do I know? I never do any of that shit, so Cece asked me."
"Cece asked you to come to Atlanta, to this restaurant at 8 p.m. tonight."
Slowly, they released their grip and stood there, lightly embracing. Hesitantly, Shane said, "She said it was for a panelist dinner."
"But you don't like people. How are you going to get through dinner?"
"My AA sponsor told me to push my limits socially. This is me growing." They looked at each other and at the romantic table for two
and realized that Cece had once again used her infinite powers to orchestrate this entire thing. Inside the restaurant, they overheard the hostess saying to a server,
"Skip the drinks menu, Paul. Just seltzer. Neither one of them drink."
Shane scratched the side of his jaw, chuckling. With a tickled sigh, Eva cast her eyes upward at the starry sky. They'd been had. The night stilled around them as they settled into the realization that they were alone, together, after wanting it so badly. Eva took the gardenia still in her hand and waved it under her nose. She wanted to have a scent to accompany this memory.
"Would you have asked me to come to Louisiana?" asked Shane.
"Yes." Eva's gaze caught his. "Would you have come?"
"I had a bag packed. I was just waiting for the word."
"I think we were wrong to end this."
Eva clutched the flower to her chest, where her heart was thundering. Shane cupped her face in his hands.
"It never ends, does it? Loving you never ends. Whether you're Genevieve or Eva, whether I lose you for years or wake up to your face every morning, I love you. You're my home, and I want you forever."
Eva blinked up at him, eyes dancing.
"Forever?"
Shane nodded, his mouth curving upward, slow and assured.
"Oh, fine," she whispered. "You can have me."
Shane beamed and ran his hand up the back of her neck into her hair. Gently, he fisted a handful and tilted her head back. Crickets chirped in that lazy midsummer way. Gardenias scented the air, and the delighted waitstaff hung back, giving the lovers their moment. They kissed, and they restarted, right where they stood.
This has been a Hachette audio production of 7 Days in June. Written by Tia Williams. Read by Mella Lee. Production supervised by Lisa Kahn. Directed by John Kovarik. Post-production by Fred Koch, Ian Lehman, and Jeremy Wesley. Recorded at Literati Audio Studios. 7 Days in June is also available in ebook format from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2021 by Tia Williams. Audio production copyright 2021 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.